We're finishing up in Hebrews chapter 11. Got just a couple of verses left, so we'll finish up there and then jump into chapter 12 without too much ado, hopefully. So I do want to kind of start off thinking about something as we're looking back now at these many great examples of faith that we've seen in Hebrews chapter 11. We've talked about people like Abraham, talked about people like Noah, Moses, Enoch, the patriarchs, then the miscellaneous, unlisted, unnamed characters of faith who accomplished great things. These are really highlights of these people's life. Many of them lived for several hundred years and probably lived many ordinary years. However, there were mountains that they had to climb that required great faith for them to overcome them. With that being said, you know, as we think about our life, we may have moments like this that come two or three times where our faith can be put on great display. But I kind of want us to think about just for a moment, maybe you're in one of those moments now. Sometimes that's something someone else may not know. But like theirs, most of our life is probably lived with faith on the ordinary daily level. And so let's just kind of looking back at that, think about this in a practical way. As we think about, you know, how different it was for them then, particularly as you see, they were suffering very, very strongly for their faith. Many of them were. And we live in a country where, thankfully, I suppose thankfully, we don't receive the same persecution. We don't receive the same oppression. We're not rejected and scorned and mistreated the same way that they are for their faith, although there seems to be a shift. And we'll talk about that a little bit maybe in chapter 12, just even in our nation. But faith on a practical daily level, you know, as we look back at chapter 11, what are some ways that faith is lived out in our life, day to day? Tommy?
Our devotions to God, you know, reading the Bible, trying to read every day, our prayer life, all that, things like that. It strengthens our faith.
Okay. So just time spent daily with the Lord. Yeah. Okay. Dick?
Willingness to help others.
Okay. A willingness to help others. I mean, that's an expression of what Jesus calls the second greatest commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. And it may not be in big ways where lots of people know about it, maybe in very small ways. And you know, just as I've been able to be on in some small way on the receiving end of three of the funerals that have taken place in the last couple of weeks, there have been a lot of those small sacrifices that were done for the families of those who had lost loved ones. And so that's an expression of faith. Just being there for someone who needs it, whether it's in a situation like that or whether it's a door that God providentially opens in our life, or just being ready to love and to serve others. Johnny?
In our society, the freedoms we have, it is easy to have a mediocre faith. You know, and maybe more trials.
Yeah, I like that. Not getting bogged down in mediocrity, because as you pointed out, just circumstantially, our times are different than theirs. The free time that we have, the abundant wealth that we have, just all of the what we consider blessings, and yes, they are if we use them rightly, but maintaining a strong faith in the midst of that and not settling for the mediocre, that's a good way faith needs to be lived out daily. Dad?
We sing a song called Take Time to Be Holy, and one of the lines that goes, each victory will help you, some other can win. I think if we can reflect on the times that we have been strong, it will spur us on to even greater faith, knowing that we have had success in the past through God and through His Word, and we have no excuses. I've done it before. I can do it again.
God's done it before. He can do it again. Yeah. Good. Anybody else? Well, let's look at the last couple of verses here, verses 39 to 40. Looking back now at this entire list, these unnamed and named heroes of faith, and all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised. Since God has provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. So, though these people were commended for their faith, it says they didn't receive what was promised. Now, some of them were given promises, and they did receive those promises. But I think the Hebrew writer has a specific promise in mind, that is the promise, if you want to look at it that way. And that promise ultimately manifesting in Jesus Christ. And so not only Christ, but all of the blessings of the new covenant that have been spoken about back in chapter 8, I think it was. These last two verses, though, they're somewhat of a challenge. If you think about, this is just something maybe to encourage us and spur us onward. You think about all of those who lived in times of old. And you think about the great demonstrations of faith that they've shown. Just powerful, trusting in the Lord. They knew much less than we do now. They were on that side of the cross, on that side of the new covenant, on that side of all the spiritual blessings that God has now poured out to us. And you see their faith. We live with the full revelation of God. We live with the full forgiveness of sins. We live fully experiencing the mercy and the grace of God in a way that they just didn't understand it prior to Christ. So then how should our faithfulness be in comparison to theirs? If the saints of old were faithful despite not receiving the promise, how can we who have received the promise then be less faithful? And his point here is also there's a solidarity, there's a community sense, and there's a sense in which all believers are benefiting from the work of Christ. And they weren't made perfect apart from us. Okay, and so when Christ came, he perfected them. And as we come to faith as well, Christ perfects us today too. And the basis of the perfection is what?
Faith.
By faith. All right, we understand now just a very comprehensive definition of what we mean, and that's just by looking at that chapter. All right. Anyone else want to comment on Hebrews 11? We're about to shut the door and move on to chapter 12 otherwise. So we have some really good discussion there, and it's one of the greatest chapters in the Bible, I believe, for a reason. So with that being said, let's go ahead and jump into chapter 12. So just kind of looking at, and that should say chapter 12, forgive the question, I just didn't correct that for this particular slideshow. So thinking about chapter 12, let's kind of get a big picture of what it's about before we dive into the verses. Anybody?
Stay the course.
Okay. Stay the course? Yep.
The last two verses you read kind of sum it up in a way.
Okay.
These were people that had made the mistake, despite that, they remained faithful, had faithful lives, are excellent witnesses and examples.
Yeah. Find a great encouragement in there. In fact, I think that's part of what the first couple of verses are about. Dave?
Okay. Go along with what David said. Stay the course, stay focused.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, that's kind of what I just distilled it down to is keep your eyes on Jesus. So it carries with it those same ideas of focusing on Christ, staying the course, remaining faithful. All good ideas. All right, let's look at the first couple of verses. Chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, so in view of everything that's been said, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So, you read these couple of verses. Paul likes to talk about it in this way, and the Hebrew writer, whether it be Paul or whether it be some other inspired person, kind of makes this analogy about a race. So, looking at those first couple of verses, what are some things we gain and we can learn about running the race of life and doing that well? Tommy?
That first verse talks about let us lay aside every weight and the sin that does easily beset us. In other words, put things out of our life that hinder us in reaching our goal to be Christ.
Okay. Yeah, let's think about that, because I think that's a significant question to consider. And I think it's just a key part. If you think about what hinders us, what hindered them was persecution, oppression, suffering, those sort of things. And what hinders us, I think, is sometimes the other side of the coin, which is abundance. Abundance and maybe a lack of persecution even. And, so he says lay aside a couple of things. Obviously, we want to lay aside sin, because sin is going to keep us from running well if we're trying to follow Christ. And so there has to be a definite putting away of that. Let's talk about the weight. What is he talking about there? What does that mean? Lay aside any weight. Dave?
Anything that would draw your attention away from the goal.
Okay.
So whatever it is, it draws my time or draws my thoughts away from what it is I'm trying to accomplish. And that, of course, is the living God of your life. And those are the things I need to try and shed off. Get rid of.
Easily recognized and easily said and understood, but very difficult to do, right? Well, let's get down into this, okay? We're coming up on a new year, and I want to encourage us to that end in spiritual growth. Probably have a little bit of this conversation Sunday morning in our sermon, but since we're here now, we might as well talk about it too. What are some things we can do? What are some of those things that hinder us? Because I think it's one thing to say, you know, I see in this verse, he says, I've got to keep my eyes fixed on Jesus. I got to lay aside the sin. I'm good with laying aside the sin. But let's be honest, it's not easy to lay aside every other weight. What are some of those things that can do that? I mean, let's just get down into it. David? Yeah, and that's, I think, you know, looking to Jesus, and so our own trusting in our own ability, we could say, pride may be something you have to set aside to run well. You're going to have to set aside pride to run well.
Yeah. I think a key that's in there too is to let us run with endurance. Endurance is not something that comes naturally. You have to work at it and build it up, and that's what he's saying here. I think looking to Jesus, building up toward what he expects from us.
Yeah, I think that's I'll touch on that in just a moment. Dave, you want to jump in real quick?
What John made me think of right there was when they saw Jesus ascend into heaven, they just all kept looking up, like he was coming right back. And that's that kind of idea, right? It's endurance. It's not a sprint. We don't know when it's going to be over. So we have to look at it like, look, I've got 80 plus years maybe to live a life that's godly. So get in there, do the dirty work, and just remember that it's going to be a life, or it could be a life. At least that, to me, would be a better mindset than thinking it's all going to be over next week. Because you would do more planning, I think, long-term planning.
We look for that, we desire that, hopefully, but the reality is, for most of us, it's not going to be a quick race. It's not going to be like the thief on the cross where you're converted and then 6 hours later you go to be with the Lord. So, as you pointed out, and this is an observation I made as well, it's a marathon, not a sprint. You know, and I'm oftentimes, I mean, it may be for some of us, but for most of us, I think it's a marathon, and I'm not much of a long-distance runner, but I imagine there's some of those you here who can testify to the pains of running long distances. I think the furthest I've ever ran just regularly is about 5 miles, but I know enough about it to say this. It reaches a point where your body doesn't want to go on anymore. And you can kind of like the Christian life, and things are going to get hard at some point, and that's just the reality. And so what you do at that point where it gets hard, whatever the challenges may be, where there's this temptation to stop running, well, that determines whether you finish or not. And John, you pointed out one of the key words that's needed there to last whenever that comes, and that's endurance. Okay, and that's kind of what's happened here to these Christians, is they've started running, but they're in danger of just dropping. And, you know, you reach a point physically with your body after you run for a while where I'm tired. I've had enough of this. You know, you may run that first mile, and I'm feeling good, but mile number two is harder, and then by the time the third mile comes, you're ready to stop. But it's what you do whenever it gets hard that determines whether you finish. And so endurance is the key that's needed to finish the race. Dave, you look like you're...
And I was just going to say, come on. That perfectly to what he was saying, therefore. So if you just bring back chapter 11 and let that marinate, that faith is what's going to give you the endurance.
Yeah.
That constant working on faith, strengthening.
Good.
Did you ever run with wire plates on your legs?
Not for long. Not for far.
You won't for long. We had some open past big back in the memory, some of those.
Oh yeah.
We had some weights and occasionally I would put them on, try to, you know, practice basketball. And I think exactly that kind of refit because it's hard to run with those weights on. You can go for a little while and stuff. You need to turn loose of it, you know.
Yeah.
We're bad about letting the worries of this world be that way. In our journey as a Christian, you know, the other's war, the other's political thing, so forth, but we're temporary here. We're temporary. This is not actually our home. We're just passing through, you know, and although we should care about our country, care about what's going on in the world, so forth, we should be.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that sojourner mentality, when you go back to chapter 11, you see that as well. It's brought out about the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, living in tents. And it's frequently brought up in the New Testament as that our citizenship's not here, it's in heaven. We're sojourners here on this earth. Tommy?
Yeah, this weight we're talking about, I think a lot of that is the sins and the way we lived our past life.
Okay.
A lot of people carry that burden, you know, they know they wasn't living the right life, you know, and it really bothers them. And I always think about the Philippians letter in verse 3, and I mean chapter 3, verse 13, where he talked about this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to do those things which are before. So we're supposed to put that past life behind us, not worry about it anymore. Start working towards the goal of being
good. Just real quick, would you raise your hand if you've got a good memory? Do you have a good memory now? You see, we're walking all over what I'm planning on talking about Sunday morning. And if there's anybody here with a good memory, I'm just going to go ahead and apologize. So that's a good question. Go check the sign. So, yes.
Corinthians chapter 10, verses 6 through 10, it tells of all the sins that the children of Israel committed in the wilderness and how God punished them for it. And then in verse 11, it says, these things were written for your admonition, that we should learn from them. But we see the flip side of the coin in chapter 12, in the first verses, as it talks about we're surrounded by this crowd of witnesses, these examples of faith. And, it's to build us up, to strengthen us, to push us forward. It encourages us for the admonition not to do this in 1 Corinthians 10. Here we have the option of to build us up through the examples of faith.
I'm glad you brought it back around to that. In fact, I was kind of going to circle back because this is an interesting phrase that's used. He says, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, obviously the people that were talked about in chapter 11 and others that we might could think about who were examples of faith. There's some uncertainty as to exactly what that means, and you hit on one of the potential explanations as to what this cloud of witnesses is doing. That is, they're witnesses of faith. And so they testify to God's faithfulness, and they testify by the life that they've lived to set a standard for us to duplicate. And so there's a sense in which this is a cloud of witness that surrounds us, a picture of faith, and they're testifying to us, this is what a faithful life looks like, and we're to imitate that. One of the other potential understandings being, though, is that these people have run the course, and they've done so faithfully, and they've done so successfully, and now they're watching us. And personally, that's always been the preferred understanding that I have when I come to this text. But I think you can probably see both elements at play. where they've run the race, and now maybe even in some sense they're you know, witnessing the struggle of those who are, you know, carrying on the faith. If you think about it like a relay race, where, you know, one person runs the first stretch, however far it is, and then they hand the baton off and the person takes it and they're running as well. Well, the person who runs, they finished their course, but what they're doing now is they're watching and they're pulling for the people that are continuing to run that same race that they did. And that's how I kind of see what's being described here, is we're surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses. And to me, that's encouraging, because yes, it's encouraging and motivating to know that God is watching us and the Lord is watching us and He knows us as to how we're living. But at the same time, to know that there are thousands of faithful people who have lived before that I believe are, have some sense of an understanding of what's taking place, and perhaps even now are under, you know, watching some of the struggles that we're going through and seeing how we're handling that. And you know, just like that relay racer who's finished, but who's continuing to cheer and pull for those who are running that same race of faith. That's how I kind of look at it. Something I've not mentioned to this point is that these Hebrew Christians would have possibly interpreted their suffering for Christ, you know, differently. Suffering was oftentimes viewed as God's displeasure. So if you suffered, it was thought that you did something to displease God. And there are instances where that can be validated. But that being said, the Hebrew writer here is, you know, thinking back. He's saying, don't misinterpret your sufferings. Don't misunderstand your sufferings. So there were Christians who were possibly thinking, okay, we're suffering for Jesus. Maybe this isn't what God wants of us. Maybe this is an expression of God's displeasure. So that could be a motivating factor that would have caused them to go back. Well, God's displeased with what I'm doing because I'm suffering, so I'm going to just return to the old ways. He was more pleased with that. And so this is another reason I think that he encourages them, because when you look at chapter 11, there's person after person after person who suffered, yet they suffered for doing the right thing. They suffered for their faith. And so he's saying, don't misinterpret your suffering. You may suffer because God is displeased, but as we're going to see, suffering doesn't always necessitate God's displeasure. So let's talk about a couple of things in verse 2. You know, significant statement here, because this is where what he ultimately wants us to see. All of those examples of faithfulness that we've seen, wonderful examples, but there's a perfect example of faith, and that is Jesus. And so that's why it says fix your eyes on Jesus. You can think about all of these others, but they're not your ultimate role model. So fix your eyes on Jesus. And he says, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So what was the joy set before Jesus as he was on the earth, as he was running the race of faith?
Pleasing his father.
Yeah, I think that was priority number one. It's pleasing his father. Yeah. Tommy?
It's going to be an complete obedience to his father.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's significant. That it brought him joy to do the Father's will. And that was part of the, I think, joy set before him. Anything else?
Should be the same for us.
Yeah, you're right. Should be.
Given his life for others.
Yeah, and I think those are the two senses in which there was the joy set before Jesus. One was he found joy in doing the will of his Father. And that should help motivate us to obedience, to know that when we obey God, even though it's not easy, that we're pleasing the Father, we're pleasing our Father, and he's pleased with our faith whenever we obey him. And secondly, giving his life to save those he loves. And so it's us. We are, in a sense, the joy that was set before Jesus. All of those he's going to bring to salvation who would otherwise have been lost. You know, we are, in a sense, the joy that was set before him. So that was the joy that was set before him that allowed him to endure what he then refers to, the shame of the cross. David, you want to jump in real quick?
Yes, I'm not going to. Sometimes there's a relay race. Sunday morning, I was talking in the first service about Coffee James Linton made a year back about the history of this church. And it's going to show the beginnings, the very first elders, the first people to start this church, and how the time's been handed through the years. And, you know, that this race we're running now was started by folks that started this church 100 some odd years ago.
Mm-hmm. And you see that generationally, don't you? A generation of Christians pass away, another generation takes the baton, and they run the race of faith, and then they hand it off to another. And as a church, what we've got to be thinking about is forward thinking. It can't end with us. It shouldn't end with us. If it ends with us, that's a problem. And so we've got to be thinking to the days ahead. We've got to be preparing those who are up and coming to run the race, to set before them a faithful example, to instruct them, to encourage them, to prepare them, So yeah, that's a great analogy. You may think about this in your life individually, but at the same time, there's a corporate sense when, you know, as you're going to tell us Sunday morning of the history of this particular congregation and, you know, where we are in the journey, we don't know, but we don't want to be the last ones carrying the baton. We want it to continue after us. And that doesn't just happen. That's takes planning and preparation to be able to do that. Good observation there. All right. So what was the shame of the cross?
Crucifixion was a really bad way, or for the worst of the worst, but that's how they killed him. You know, it was a bad thing. It was a shameful thing. But for Jesus, he endured the cross and made it shameless. His part was shameless.
Okay, so yeah, I think you touched on a certain element of the shame of the cross is the humiliation. One, the humiliation of death, when you think of who Jesus was and is, and just how low he humbled himself to come to this earth, and then to die in the way that he did. And he didn't die, you know, some noble, valiant death. This was, as you pointed out, a shameful death. It was a humiliating death. It was a painful death. And so I think, you know, the way that he gave his life is part of the shame, part of the humiliation that he endured. Tommy?
Yeah, I believe in the Old Testament, the Jewish tradition was if he was hung in a tree, if he was accursed.
Yeah, Galatians 3:13. He became a curse for us. Yeah, so cursed is anyone who hangs on a tree. You're right. Okay, so the humiliation of his death, and that ties in well to another element that I think is at play. Anybody want to take a shot at that? The bearing of sin. Okay, he became a curse for us. You were cursed. If you were hung on a tree, that was a curse. Okay, and so we're told in Galatians 3:13, like you pointed out, Tommy, that Jesus became a curse for us. So there's a sense in which there's this humiliation in the way that he died. But not only that, but Jesus in all of his perfection, in all of his goodness, and I'm not going to try to probe and explain how this happened. I can only tell you what Scripture says. And in 2 Corinthians 5:21, it says, he became sin who knew no sin, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. And 1 Peter 2:24 would tell us that Jesus in his body bore our sin on the tree. So if you think for Jesus, which of those would have been worse? The humiliation of death or the bearing of sin? To me, it's no comparison. We often talk about, you know, his suffering and his pain and his anguish on the cross and those hours leading up to it and the tortures and the mistreatment at the hands of the Romans and the Jews and his people and the humiliation he suffered. And certainly that's a significant part of it as well. But for the sinless Son of God to, in some sense, you know, bear the sin of humanity on the cross, to become a curse, to be made sin in some way. I don't know what that is, and I'm not going to try to explain it, but that's the very present element of Jesus' death. And so those two things coupled together, I see, are the humiliation of his death and then the bearing of sin or the shame of the cross. Dave, did you have your hand? Do you want
to
jump in? Yeah. Something was happening there that beyond, and I don't know how far I'd necessarily push this, but I stand on the fact that there was more to Jesus' death than just an atoning sacrifice being shed. Okay. I might not go as far as some, but at the same time, there's just certain things that can't be denied, and I think Jesus being the sinless Son of God and then in some sense bearing the weight of sin, I don't know in what capacity, and I don't know the specifics, but in some sense he did. And to me, that was part of the shame of the cross. All right, so Jesus is the founder and perfecter of our faith. That is, he began it and he brought it to completion, and he's now seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So his saving work is complete, that idea of being seated there. So let's look at verses 3 through 6. So consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. So Jesus is the ultimate example of perseverance. When we become weary and we're tempted to faint, tempted to pull off, tempted to stop running a race, Jesus is the one that we look at. And it says in verse 4, in your struggle against sin, you've not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. So the sin the believers are struggling against is likely not personal sin that they're tempted to give into, but rather it's the sin of those who are trying to terrorize them to abandon the race and to turn from their faith in Jesus. Now, this is a troubling statement. Imagine being someone to whom this letter was written. And then you read this and you read these words, "In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood." What's the implication buried there? Do you hear it?
It's going to come a time you will have to shed blood.
It's not yet. But, yeah, this seems to be heading in that direction. This sounds like an ominous pronouncement that things are going to get worse in the future. It hasn't happened yet, but the possibility of you suffering to the point of death for your faith in Christ is something that that can become a reality. In fact, we know historically, as we think about when the Hebrew letter was written, probably, what did we say, 63 to 66 or 66 to 69, I can't remember, mid-60s. We know that persecution for the Christians are going to get significantly worse. And, you know, depending where you were at geographically, just in proximity to Rome and some of the cities where Christianity and other faiths were less tolerated, then persecution was very great. And in fact, so at this point, there have been multiple martyrs. Peter died, I believe, in 67, and it's possible the letter to the Hebrews could be written a little bit after that. Actually, is Peter's name mentioned at the end of the letter? I may be missing the date on that. Timothy is one at the end of chapter 13:23. You should know that our brother Timothy has been released. So at this point, Peter's likely dead. Paul was probably put to death in 64. So there have been multiple martyrs for the faith at this point in time. But if you think about it, those were ringleaders. Okay, they were prominent men. And that's where they're going to try to cut off the head first and then hope the body would die. Obviously, that didn't work. And so now he's writing to Christians, not leaders, not in necessarily a prominent, influential position, and say, "You've not yet resisted to the point of blood." And so the way that he words it makes it sound like that's somewhere there in the future. And if you think about it, the first or second bell? Second bell? Okay. If you think about it, we're in a position that's similar to those Hebrew Christians in regard to suffering. If you think about what they were enduring, it says you haven't yet resisted to the point of blood. That's kind of where we are. These Christians, these Hebrew Christians, they're scorned, they're ostracized, they're hated, they're stolen from. And Christians in our country can experience those things, this ostracization, this scorn, this hatred, being stolen from through the court system. And so I don't know that we're terribly far from a statement like this being made to us. And so I'll just, with that ominous pronouncement, we'll pick up next week kind of thinking about some of the things that they suffered and the ways that they suffered and just where they went from there, and then think about where we are. It's my full belief that as Christians we need to prepare for suffering of some sort, because things seem to be transitioning where Christians are beginning to suffer within our country more and more for their faith in the Lord, and only the Lord knows what that'll look like ultimately, but we need to be prepared for whatever's to come, because we may not have it easy, and our children may not have it easy as we do and as our parents did. So we'll pick up with this idea of suffering next week in Hebrews chapter 12. Thank you for your comments and your participation in our class tonight.